This is Kim Fowley, the rock and roll West Coast legend from Hollywood, USA. You are listening to Mark After Dark, the only disc jockey in the world that asks amazing questions.
In the summer of 1959, you were stationed in Idaho and became a radio disc jockey, becoming the voice of the Treasure Valley. Throughout the years, you have become a radio personality, a voice to music, and now you have been on Sirius XM. What would you say is the biggest difference to being on air now to back in 1959?
We're all well-mannered and kind and human and concerned with the well-being of our listeners. And back in those days, we were crusaders for the religion of rock and roll.
Mm-hmm.
We couldn't care less about our listeners. We just cranked up the music and wanted to wake up the world and that kind of startling stuff. I was also 19 and a half years old. I'm 74 now, so you play a Little Richard record in the middle of Idaho, you're going to get people yelling and screaming and shaking their fists and other people dancing in the street at the same time, and you're dividing up parents and children and all of that. So it was, how many records can you play in a row that'll just shake the foundations of a town, you know?
Mm-hmm.
So that was what I was doing as an on-air guy and back then.
Okay.
Now I'm concerned that my listeners in New York City don't ever know who their neighbors are. And they don't walk through a yard to get to their homes. They walk upstairs or downstairs, and they don't see green things other than dollar bills in there. So New York people don't get to see a bulldog fighting a chihuahua in a non-existent yard, because you don't have yards in New York. Over here in Los Angeles, we don't have culture, according to you guys in New York. All we are is an orange grove next to an ocean and a desert.
Well, I don't know about that. There's some things about California that are very cultured. But anyway.
Well, California, the Southern California, Hollywood, where I am, is basically fake.
Yeah.
But so is everything. But everybody just, everybody has new breasts, new lips, new brains, new names. What's your name? Trevor St. John. How were you born? Jerome Rosenberg.
Oh, God.
You know, that's the whole deal, you know. And you come out here, you get a new name and new body parts, and then you write a resume that you create for yourself, and there you are, you know. But that's how it works here. Now, maybe in New York, when you went through Ellis Island in the 19th century, Joe Kowalski became Jack Kelly, because the guy just didn't want to, I'll give the guy an Irish name, I have a better chance in Pittsburgh. So, you know, fake is everywhere.
Of course. I've always been a big fan of Alan Freed, and I know you were a food runner, among other things, for Alan Freed.
Right.
You protected him at his record hops. And
well, I could fight, and I was Army Air Force trained, hand-to-hand combat guy.
Mm-hmm.
I knew how to kill people, so if anyone jumps in front of me and hits me first, I respond. But I don't ever hit anyone. You have to hit me first, and then I don't hit you. I win the altercation any way I can.
Well, also, from those hops, can you tell me some stories of some of your favorite hops that you did?
We did the Mayan Theater in downtown L.A., where everybody was Hispanic except he and I and his wife,
mm-hmm.
and the artists were black, and all of a sudden everybody was brown. We're white. It was kind of interesting, you know.
Mm-hmm.
That was probably the most unexpected cultural, fusion? That was before L.A. was a melting pot, you know. Now you have 56 language groups in the city, and you could grow up here and never speak English.
In 1957-58, you managed a band called the Sleepwalkers, which included Bruce Johnston, who later joined the Beach Boys, and occasionally Phil Spector on guitar. Can you give me more details of that experience.
Well, Sandy Nelson was the drummer. He had two hits, Let There Be Drums and Teen Beat, earlier on.
Mm-hmm.
And I was in high school, and they were in high school, and I was their pimp, their musical pimp.
Mm-hmm.
And it was tempting adults to give guys with pimples work, playing rock and roll music, R&B music and rockabilly music, as opposed to Dinah Shore music or Patti Page music or Pat Boone music. And of course, there was lots. All right. There was lots of, just the middle one, and there was a lot of static about that. We played the Jewish temple, and then we go across the street to the Catholic CYO dance. And, which ones are you, Jews or Catholics? And we'd say, well, gelt and guilt, there's no difference. Just a couple of letters. We're agnostic teenagers in search of women like Frank Sinatra has sex with, if possible. Any other dumb questions?
And sorry.
Then, of course, they'd...
yeah, I've got a ton of
mad.
Them.
They get mad about that. What does Frank Sinatra, I mean, my God, he's not dating somebody with pimples. But you guys have pimples. Right. We're teenagers.
In 1960, the Hollywood Argyles recorded the song Alley Oop. You co-produced this song with Gary Paxton, which hit number one on Billboard's Hot 100.
Right.
This would be your first number one record. What was it like having a song reach number one, and did you realize at that point that you had made it in the music business?
No, because they thought we were a bunch of idiots that accidentally produced it and that we would fail in our future because we didn't have one. And nobody told us we were gifted or congratulated us or asked us to join their company or merged with us or assisted us. They were mad that two 20-year-old guys produced it. There were 20-year-olds who sang stuff, but not the producers and the co-publishers and all of that.
Mm-hmm.
We had an adult role in the project. We didn't have a teenage dip role in the project. And so... people who I went to school with said, well, you're not going to graduate from college now, are you? No. And then they said, well, we will, and we'll have a better middle-aged and senior citizen life than you. I said, yeah, but I'm number one in the world over Elvis Presley's number two, which I learned from tonight. Think of my dating potential and future, you moron. And we didn't, black people liked it because we were white guys. And it sounded black. Well, it sounded black because we had a black band. We
mm-hmm.
had Ronnie Millsap on drums, who was in Peanut Butter by the Marathons. He played drums. He later played as John Mayall. And then Gaynell Hodge co-wrote Earth Angel for the Penguins on keyboard, and he also was in Hollywood Flames. And then Harper Cosby played on Willie and the Hand Jive, which is an immortal record. By Johnny Otis. So I had these amazing black guys, and we were white idiots. We had one Mexican and a guy, and we had a girl who was a church singer, and then we had Sandy Nelson screaming like a caveman, and Gary, and the writer, and Dallas Frazier, and Dave Martinez, who was a dishwasher from Tucson. That was a real Hollywood Argyles on the A side of the record. And, well, you couldn't put Mexicans and church girls and white trash guys and black people, called Negroes then, on stage. They would have burned the theater down. This is before Martin Luther King went to Selma, Alabama in March. This is before Motown
mm-hmm.
had Shop Around. Because I had worked at Motown later, and we had Way Over There by the Miracles, which I promoted on Tamla, and that record went to 96. Of course, Shop Around, everybody went to number one in 61, but we were out there, making black music with white people. And then white audience and the black audience bought the record, and that was that. It was a one-hit wonder project. I became a lead singer later in 66. The last Hollywood Argyles record was Kim Fowley singing Long Hair on Square Dude Called Jack, covered by Manfred Mann, and later covered by The Cream, and then they had the Atlantic Records fire, and all the tapes burned down, including The Cream doing that song, which Jack Bruce imitating Kim Fowley. I mean, come on, you know. So having Alley Oop, they didn't have hit albums then, they had a hit single.
Mm-hmm.
And we had a hit single, and the album and the follow-up failed. And then by the time December had rolled around, we were broke because we were only paid on 700,000 singles. And we had to break into Hollywood Argyle's fan club piggy bank in order to eat TV dinners for Christmas. And that was what happened to us. We were despised and ignored and overlooked because all of a sudden, what are 20-year-old guys doing, producing records? And he had hits later. Gary Paxton was Monster Mash by Bobby Boris Pickett. He produced him and on his own label and had success, went to number one. And then I had hits with Popsicles and Icicles.
By the yes, you did.
Mm-hmm. Went to number one. And also, I had Nut Rocker, which went to number one in 17 countries outside America. And then later on, through the years, in no particular order, everything from Kiss to the Alice Cooper.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
All did songs I wrote or co-wrote and
mm-hmm.
produced everybody from Helen Reddy to
Well, I have questions for you.
It goes on and on. I can't sit here all day. I sold 102 million records by the time it was all over.
Mm-hmm.
The career. Now, I don't produce records. Now I'm on the radio, Sirius XM, 9 o'clock in the morning to 1 o'clock in the afternoon, Pacific Standard Time, repeat midnight to 4 Pacific Time. You can hear this on the radio, his voice. And then I'm an actor. I'm doing all kinds. I play cripples. I'm a guy in a wheelchair, and I'm a guy on a walker. And I have body bags and wiring in my body. It isn't my body parts. I'm messed up physically, and people want to film that kind of a guy who can talk like this, who looks like that, like Jesus Christ and Sister Kenny and Tiny Tim from A Christmas Carol by Charles Dickens, all tossed together in this Frankenstein look-alike face and body, and that's what you get.
Mm-hmm.
When you see me coming along and on television, in the next 45 days, I'm not allowed to mention it, but I'm one of the biggest New York-based artists right now. They're making this new thing now where they make short movies or like these big-budget videos, $1 million a piece, and it's just a song, and this collection of million-dollar videos come out, and it's sort of like watching a movie of an album. Are you familiar with, I don't know what that's called, but are you familiar with the technology and the marketing of that? Well, I did two of those. They had so many people on the set, it looked like a small town. It looked like Woodstock.
Wow.
And there I am in the wheelchair, and there I am with all of the wiring. And on the second video, I said, hey, I look like an Auschwitz version of Jesus Christ with all this bladder bag action going on and the gnarled body. What did you put that on? And he did. The director said, oh, yeah. And then everybody was shocked. And it was, you'll see it on TV. You'll see it on YouTube, and people will shake their fist, get mad about that. Someone will find it offensive and horrific. And I don't mean to do this, but here's a chance to make four figures.
Oh, you got to do what you got to do.
I'm making five figures the day. I just was diagnosed with a new tumor.
Oh,
and
geez.
After, which I go on Thursday for my biopsy, and then I have two other horrific test to do on January 7th, and I start shooting a movie on June 7th, on June 9th, and the guy wants me to sing in a wheelchair, and he saw me at the Don't Knock the Rock Film Festival singing with David Bowie's voice, which roughly would be, and when you told me goodnight, I can't do it without the piano, but everyone is feeling like a sapphire ring in the sky. again you cry for me.
You're actually
so
pretty good.
So I did
good.
That with a piano and wearing a suit and a wheelchair, and people, only I did a Q&A about famous actors and old directors. It was a film festival for an hour, and then went outside, and I was, then I did Bob Dylan, like, everybody knows you are me. I did that voice for 2.5 hours, did hypnosis, a total of almost 4 hours, and the guy, big deal movie director, Paul, D-U-A-N-E, I don't know if it's Dwan or Dwayne, from Ireland, he said, I'm giving you money, I'm going to make the movie of you as this crippled madman showing up, riding shotgun with death through infinity. Are we ready? That's my line, by the way. Are we ready? I should pay money. I perform like a talking dog, you know, so I have to do 2 live gigs after this hospital crap in front of bikers and army, no, Marines and Navy guys, all crammed into a room singing stuff. And but I'm getting 12 grand, you know.
You got to do what you got to do.
Well, yeah. So I, for anybody who's handicapped, get someone to take a picture of you naked. You might find love or money doing so. And instead of, I don't love Brad Pitt, so I better give up being loved or touched, you know.
Mm-hmm. In 1966, you went to England and discovered a band called the Inbetweens playing in a club called Tiles. You were awed by their sound and wanted to produce them. So in one day there were 9 songs recorded. The band would later hit legendary status in England as Slay. Tell me some stories about their historic recording.
Well, Noddy Holder has it all in his book. It has a red cover and him standing on it. He's the lead singer. He wrote a book. It's out there. It's a hardcover. And I guess they were geniuses, because when they came to record, they brought all their gear, and the drummer carried the bass drum in front of him, and he wrapped the rest of the drum set and cymbals around his body and rolled on a train all the way across England.
Wow.
And the bass player had his bass, and then the guitar player had his guitar, and guitar, bass, and drums, and I said, okay. So we had 8 songs, and we cranked them out. And then the 9th one was me singing with them about an ugly girl or something. And we went to EMI, and they put it out, and You Better Run, the Rascals song we covered. That was the single, and it failed. It went to number 1 in Wolverhampton, where they were from. Then what happened was, then they became Ambrose Slade and cut their hair off and were like a skinhead band. Then after they were Ambrose Slade, they became Slade. And then they basically had number 1 records everywhere except America and Japan and Canada. But everywhere else in the world, they were number 1 for a long time.
Oh, yeah.
Quiet Riot, Come On, Feel the Noise, they wrote.
And Mama, We're All Crazy Now.
Yeah, they wrote that too. And so they redeemed themselves. I got them early. I was 6 years early, and I went to dinner with them at the Rainbow Bar and Grill, which is a rock and roll sleazeball hangout with good food here.
Mm-hmm.
And Chas Chandler was their producer. We all sat there. I said, I was too early, you were too late for them to be Beatles. And we all sat there, and they got caught right in that middle ground at the end of the... In 66, it was too late to be the Beatles. They were too young. And in 72, time had passed them by, and Bowie showed up. And then Sweet showed up and had a bigger international career outside of wherever they had number 1 records. And so that's too bad.
Yeah, they were a great band.
They were. I didn't know it at the time, but Kiss, who I later wrote songs with...
Yeah, I know.
They were disappointed. Maybe they weren't Slade. I don't think they ever knew to this day that I produced Slade.
Mm-hmm.
As the same 4 guys under another name. Same
yeah.
sound.
Yeah. Well, also in 1966, you co-wrote a song with Cat Stevens called Portobello Road, which appeared as a B-side
on his first Durham single, I Love My Dog. How did you meet Cat Stevens, and how did the idea for the song come about?
I met Cat Stevens in the lobby of Ardmore Beachwood Music Publishing, who had both of us as songwriters, and I gave him a lyric I had written.
Mm-hmm.
And he was so shy, he went down the street and wrote it in a telephone call box and then called up and sang it over the phone. And then came back, and that's how it happened. And he, pretty shy person who had a unique problem. His problem, his mother was from Sweden and didn't speak English. His dad was from Greece and didn't speak English.
Mm-hmm.
They didn't speak Swedish. The Greek guy and the woman didn't speak... And he didn't speak, she didn't speak Greek. So no one could talk to each other. Except the kids all learned English and didn't learn Greek or Swedish.
Wow.
How about that?
That's amazing.
When you meet him, he's one of the quietest guys in the world. Well, no wonder he's quiet. Who's going to talk to you?
Wow.
Like your brother and sister, you know?
Mm-hmm. Well, you also met Jimi Hendrix when you lived in Bayswater. Did you realize at that time that he was going to become a musical icon?
Oh, yeah. He was very unique.
Mm-hmm. Could you tell me some stories?
When I first met him, I said, what do you do? He said, I do science fiction rock and roll.
Mm-hmm.
I said, what's that? And he said, he played me Martian War Machine, which became an album cut later on. And I said, all right. What do you say? He said, you note, he said that the lyrics are like science fiction books and the music, the guitar playing is like a rocket ship. He never said the word psychedelic at all. And he carried with him a sea chest full of science fiction books. Jimi Hendrix used to sit in his hotel room and read books all day long when he was rehearsing or recording before the first record hit.
Mm-hmm.
So that was his story.
Can you tell me more about your friendship with Keith Moon, and were you a fan of The Who?
I thought The Who were good. He played too many cymbals, and he owes me 20 English pounds.
Yeah, I heard about that. I don't think you're going to get your 20, so I guess you never got your 20 English pounds.
I'll get it in hell.
How did you meet Keith Moon?
Oh, probably the Top of the Pops.
Mm-hmm. What were you doing at Top of the Pops to meet them?
I think I had recorded The Coming to Take Me Away. The Coming to Take Me Away, ha ha, hee ho ho, the funny farmer. Sped up voice, and I had a version of it that was number one in Denmark and New Zealand, and then somebody else, the original guy, had it every other country. I was on CBS, and he was on Warner Brothers.
Mm-hmm. Oh, well, you were also featured on Mothers of Invention's album, Freak Out. Do you have any stories about Frank Zappa, and did you realize he was going to become a cult figure in music?
No, I just thought he was a guy who didn't pay me any royalties or session fees for singing Help I'm a Rock and doing vocal arrangements on other songs on the album, according to Dr. John the Night Tripper, who told Mojo Magazine that I was the one doing the vocal arrangements, which probably is true because Frank was in the studio producing the thing with the guy who got credit for producing it, Tom somebody, who also produced Sounds of Silence, but so Frank actually produced the record, and the other guy put his name on it. And then I did the vocal arrangements and didn't give my name on as vocal arranger, but he got credit for being a vocal arranger and the artist and the guitar player and the writer. And but we did it in one night, that album. A lot of weird stuff going on, all the crowd scenes and choruses. Danny Hutton sang on it. He didn't get paid either. He later formed Three Dog Night. And Les McCann, the jazz genius, played on it. He didn't get paid. Frank had the, hey, everybody, let's have a party. Oh, we're all, you guys sing and play on this album, and you can have all the food you want.
Mm-hmm.
And other refreshments that were there. And no drugs, because he was a non-drug person. And so you know, he later asked me to be Brian Jones. He said, "You're my Brian Jones. Would you like to be my Brian Jones?" I said, "No. I'd rather be Kim Fowley, because I used to produce records. When the 60s are over, so I'll go back to it again." And I should have stayed in the Mothers of Invention. I have name credit as a featured vocalist on there, but I don't have any other credit. But if I would have sung on four more albums, I could have been the Turtles, or Flo and Eddie or something, or it would have justified some weird records I made under my own name, which people say, "Ooh, where are you coming from?"
Mm-hmm.
The Mothers of Invention. "Oh, how many albums did you do?" "One." "Well, that doesn't count." But I went to New York and performed at the Cafe Wa, and the Fugs came and saw us, and I trampled a rubber doll on stage in front of the original Mothers of Invention as their Brian Jones. I tried it once. And then I played in L.A. at the Shrine Auditorium more than once, and other gigs. I'm good on stage, and he was good, and he was all business, no messing around. That was a guy who took his humor seriously.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, I'll tell you something. Gene Simmons, John Waters, and Frank Zappa all have the same persona off stage.
Yeah, I know. They're all real businessmen, totally.
Oh, yeah. Gene Simmons is the best, because he does it with a flair and flourish, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And John Waters does it with humor, and Frank Zappa did it with sort of dislike of lesser mortals.
Well, talking about your solo work, in 1968 you released your third solo album, Outrageous, which was my favorite. The album got on the Billboard charts at 198. You got a fan letter from Ted Nugent. Were you a fan of the Amboy Dukes? And did
Yeah, I thought that record on mainstream was great. I thought that was really sensational, and I appreciated it.
Mm-hmm.
I had a regional hit of the album in Detroit, and when I performed there, I created some weird events in Detroit through the years.
Mm-hmm. Well, getting a letter from Ted Nugent, were you a fan of the Amboy Dukes?
I appreciated the record. I didn't know anything about them.
What about getting banned in Florida?
Apparently I was banned in Florida, but that could have been a crank phone call from someone across the street in Hollywood pretending
mm-hmm.
to be. There was never documents about it. It was just, "Hi, we're from Florida. Attorney General's office. Kim Fowley said some things on the radio in the context of the lyrics of his song Animal Man that we find offensive. He's now banned in Florida. Nobody will play his records."
Wow.
Okay, great. And then that was that. It could have just been some guys having fun at the Pancake House, you know.
Yeah, well, how would you compare writing and producing a song or record for an artist to recording it on your own?
Same.
The same thing?
Sure, because it's just making noise in the recording studio.
In 1970, you worked on Warren Zevon's first album, Dead or Alive. You also co-wrote the title track. I know you and Warren didn't really get along, and you left after disagreements. Can you give me more details of what happened between you and him?
Yeah, he was an egomaniac that was unproducible.
Mm-hmm.
And so I said, "You figure it out." And I walked away, and he did one of my songs. I named the album after the song "Wanted Dead or Alive." And I did the same thing about 3 months ago with Ariel Pink.
Mm-hmm.
You know who that is.
Yeah.
And he and I wrote 6 songs together, and he was unproducible too. So I said, "Do it yourself," and he did 5 of the 6 songs that we co-wrote. So I'm not everybody's favorite person in the studio. I get it done fast.
Mm-hmm.
And not everybody wants to work fast.
Okay, well, in 1973, you produced and recorded 3 songs by Flash, Cadillac, and the Continental Kids for the film American Graffiti.
Right.
The songs were At the Hop, Louie Louie, and She's So Fine. What was your opinion of that film?
George Lucas is God. What else? I mean, what a genius. And he gave me points on it, and I had points on 10 million units. as producer of three songs. I didn't work for a couple of years. And he still pays royalties, that guy. After all these years, he still pays royalties.
Wow.
And all the actors, some of whom went on to big things, like Richard Dreyfuss and...
Ron Howard.
And Harrison Ford were all only paid Screen Actors Guild. He then gave them pieces of the back end of the movie.
Wow.
And they get that all the time, too. So he's a gentleman. You know, he's one of the few guys who, you know, does that type of stuff, you know.
Well, in 75, you co-wrote the song Escape on Alice Cooper's Welcome to My Nightmare album. Some of the lyrics to that song I find very amusing. Tell me about that experience.
It was another day of songwriting, you know. I just write all the time. I don't think about it. It's all reflex.
Okay. Well, in 76, like you talked about, you know, Kiss. In 1976, not only producing and introducing the world to the Runaways, you co-wrote songs with Kiss on their Destroyer album. The songs are King of the Nighttime World and Do You Love Me? How did you get involved in the songwriting process with Kiss, and how did these songs come about?
Bob Ezrin invited me to submit material, and I did, and they accepted them.
That's the whole story.
Same on Alice Cooper.
Okay. Well, you formed the Runaways in 1975. The band featured Joan Jett, Sandy West, and Mickey Steele, who later joined the Bangles.
Yeah.
The main recording of this early period of the band was a bunch of demos recorded in August of 75. Mickey Steele claims she was fired from the band because she refused her sexual propositions and called the band's debut single Cherry Bomb stupid. What's the real story of her firing?
She was fired for being unattractive and not being a good front person and wanting to be in Gentle Giant, and was 22 pretending to be 16, and the other two were 16, Sandy and Joan. So the question is, if a chick is unattractive and you fire her for being unattractive, then why would you make sexual advances toward an ugly girl or a plain girl or a Gentle Giant wannabe woman? Answer, you don't. She's not going to admit, I was fired for not being as good a front woman as Sheree Curry was, who did sing Cherry Bomb lead, which knocked the Eagles out of number one in Japan with Cherry Bomb. So Cherry Bomb outsold Hotel California in Japan, so it wasn't stupid. Japan was the second largest country and still is for record sales and music sales in the world.
Recently, you're working with Sheree Curry and Lita Ford. What's it like working with them again?
The police came because there was too much noise going on, and we all went to jail over the recording because it was loud and aggressive. Hey folks, I've got to do dialysis because I've got a new tumor. My name is Kim Fowley, and this isn't humor, it's real. Right, Lady Satan?
That's right.
Okay, so I've got to go and go through all that Holocaust kind of medication. If you like this show, tell Mark After Dark about it, and then maybe you'll have me on for round two.
Oh, good.
Hollywood Confidential comes to the Big Apple. Happy holidays, everyone.
Thank you, Kim.